Welcome to the next episode in Gospel Conversations. We're continuing to repost some of the gems from the past. Last time we posted the first talk that Ian Proven gave in 2011 on the book of Genesis. And in that talk, he situated the creation account of Moses in contrast to the reigning ancient Near Eastern worldviews and cosmology. In this particular talk, he begins the first of two talks on the first verse of the Bible, "In the beginning, God created." And this particular talk is "Who is God?" Although we've retitled it for this series, "Was Dawkins Right About God?" The talk has a lot of resonance with the other series we're doing in Breakfast with Jesus, where I'm going through Ezekiel and the temple. In the upcoming series we're going to be doing called "What is the Gospel?" And also echoes back into our Cross and Creation series. I think you'll really enjoy this talk. What Ian is very, very good at doing is giving you a reconnaissance across a very broad landscape. And this is a really foundational talk for any believer, really. The kind of foundations that we all too rarely give people, which is the foundations of creation and the Judeo-Christian view of creation. I'll leave you with his final words, which conclude this talk, which are just beautiful. He asks what picture of religion this Judeo-Christian view of creation leaves us with, and he says religion it means entering joyfully into the work of God in the world. As he said, the view of God presented in Genesis is night and day with the fearful, anxiety-ridden view of the gods in the ancient Near Eastern world. The Genesis picture of creation leaves us rejoicing about being co-workers with God.
This was a pretty daunting topic, even at an hour and a quarter, Tony. So, but we'll do it. We'll do our best. So, we've kind of set the background, I hope, and really the two talks that I now want to give at the moment and later this afternoon are really both talks about the first five words of our English Bibles, "In the beginning God created." That's all we're going to talk about, basically. So, in the beginning God created, in a moment, and then this afternoon, in the beginning God created. Now, last evening, if you were here, I was asked an interesting question about myths and misconceptions, and I said I was going to start off this bit with a ferocious quote from Richard Dawkins. And I want to do that because I think it's always important to not only talk about the ancient context, but also to recognize what the modern context is in which we ask a question like, "Who is God?" So let's just look at Richard Dawkins. "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all of fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully." I mean, he is a good writer in a way. I mean, you've got to admire. He really enjoyed that, you know. It's really good stuff. So I actually think, though, that this does represent, I mean, it's a quite extreme version of it, but it does represent a mood, shall we say. If you ever try and talk about the Old Testament to folks outside the church, or even inside the church for that matter, you know, something of this kind of atmosphere, you know, kind of permeates the conversation. So it makes this business of how we read our Bibles against this historical background to and how we read them for guidance on what we should believe about who God is, it makes it very important, I think. This is, by the way, have you heard about this? This was Richard Dawkins went on the 2008, he put together an atheist bus campaign, which is a bit like an evangelistic move on the part of atheists. And his slogan was, "There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life." So he does have a penchant for capturing the public imagination. Earlier on, I used the idea of the oneness of God just to illustrate the significance of knowing something about the background. I just have a couple of more things to say about this business of the oneness of God, God not being many, just to fill that out very briefly. And then I want to go on to address the Dawkins quote more particularly. One of the other things that's very important to notice about what our Bibles tell us about God is that God has no point of origin within the cosmos. So it's not just that God is one and not many, but you remember the other gods are with us on the inside of this great big circle, as it were, and are viewed as coming into being along with the cosmos, associated with all of these elements of creation we talked about. That is obviously another way in which our Bibles are very different. It's not that we're not told that God is, as it were, somewhere else and not with us here, but we are told, I think, as clearly as we can be, that this God is not continuous with us in the sense of being inside the circle, if you like. This is the importance of the biblical notion of creation, which is not just moving the furniture around. It is about function and naming, but it's also about genuine creation. So that's another important detail with regard to the one God, not many. Think of a psalm like Psalm 90, verse 2, for example. "Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God." And set that text against the background. You see the power of that against the background now? Maybe if it's just our modern context and we're in church, that verse doesn't really strike us as particularly odd. When you read it against this context, you see, wow, that's a really powerful piece of polemic that's being stated there. So God is one, God is without origin in creation, and God is also completely sovereign over creation in biblical thinking. That's another important connected point. These ancient gods we were talking about earlier could not possibly be sovereign over creation because they came into being as part of creation. They have to pay attention to the basic shape of creation, even in what they do. So they're like us. They're limited. There are also many of them, so they can't really be sovereign anyway, right? And if you know the old myths of the Greeks and so on, you'll find the gods fighting with each other. And you never know who you are, because where you are, you may please Zeus and really take off Poseidon, you know, because they control different bits to the extent they control anything at all. So this notion that God is completely sovereign over creation is well expressed, I think, also in our biblical tradition. Isaiah 40 would be a good example. "To whom will you compare me? Who is my equal?" says the Holy One. "Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name." Notice the naming. "Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing." Right? So you look at the heavens, and these are not competing deities. These are creatures of God. And Isaiah really puts that nicely. So that's just to fill out the idea we were playing with a bit earlier on, all under this heading, one God and not many. God has no origin in the cosmos. God has no rival. Therefore, God is sovereign. And then, in that last text I just read you, this notion, therefore, that God is incomparable. "To whom will you compare me?" Obviously, setting the Lord God of Israel in the context of these ancient gods is a natural question to ask, right? Compare and contrast. What's going on? And the conviction of the biblical authors, who knew even better than you and I the nature of that polytheistic environment, the conviction that they come back to again and again and again is that this God is not to be compared with any other God. You find this in the Exodus story, for example, when they sing this song, "Who among the gods is like you, O Lord? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders?" It's a rhetorical question, right? Who is like you? There's no one like this. Why do they sing that? Well, God has just separated the waters of the sea and brought out dry land for them to walk on, which of course is a replay of the creation story, right? Bringing dry land out of the midst of the waters. And of course the song is asking the question, which other God can do that? And the answer is, well no one can. Various other texts, Psalm 77, what God is so great as our God? Who in the skies, Psalm 89, who in the skies above can compare with the Lord? Now we now know there are contenders for that, the sun and the moon and so on. Who can compare? Well, nothing can compare. So the biblical conviction you see from all of this is that the many gods that are worshipped in the ancient world are in fact not gods at all. That's the radical, countercultural, offensive view that the Israelites arrive at. These are not gods at all. These are all simply aspects of creation. And that's why Deuteronomy chapter 4 tells the Israelites to acknowledge and take to heart this day that the Lord is God in heaven above and on earth below. There is no other. Now, that text doesn't mention the underworld, but I think we can include the underworld there, obviously, because of what other texts tell us. All of this explains, then, why it is that the Israelites are commanded in their sacred text to refrain from worshipping these other entities. This is not simply a gratuitous, arbitrary kind of instruction, as it were. It's not, as Dawkins might think, that God is somewhat insecure, you know, and doesn't want people hanging out with other gods. That's not the issue. The conviction the Israelites have is that these other things are not gods at all. And so you will know the very famous text known as the Shema among Jewish people in Deuteronomy 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your strength. And there's a connection between those two things, right? God is one. Therefore, we must each love God in a unified way with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. There's no division. No division of loyalties allowed. God is one, we must be one, and that's the nature of our God-human relationship. It's a one-to-one relationship, actually. And the significance of that way of putting it is starker now. We know what the alternatives were. This leads on then to the notion that whereas in the ancient world we have a pluralist system of belief, inevitably in the Israelite way of thinking we do not. There is such a thing as false religion and true religion in the biblical way of thinking, because there is such a thing as a true God and other things which are not gods but are being worshipped as such. And so Deuteronomy and other texts, you know, quite robustly describe these other gods as being simply wood and stone who cannot see or hear or eat or smell. They're not real. They don't have any real living reality to them. Now, you can well imagine that the peoples of the ancient Near East that we were talking about earlier would likely not have accepted that characterization of their gods as being inanimate objects, simply of wood and stone, because we saw they had a very serious sense of the embodiment of deity in their images. So they would not have agreed with that analysis, but that certainly is the biblical perspective. Remember, to these ancient peoples, because these gods were persons, they were even looked after like persons in terms of the rituals of the day. The Old Testament certainly accepts the idea that God is personal. The Old Testament even accepts that there's some analogy to be drawn between God's personhood and ours. To that extent, there's an agreement, I suppose, with the general context. Of course, the most famous way in which the Bible puts that is when it says that we are made in God's image. So there's some connectedness of personhood there. God is like us, maybe. We're certainly like God. And yet, at the same time, there's distance set in biblical thinking. It's not the same kind of personhood. God is not conceived of simply as a larger version of us in the Bible. That there is a proper way of speaking about that analogy, but there's also what we might call a gap in personhood. Earlier on, I said that the gods of the ancient world were regarded as capable of sexual activity, procreation, and so on. Certainly, that's not true of God in the Old Testament. God's not like a human being in those senses. Psalm 121, we noted earlier on in verse 4 of that psalm, we are told that God neither slumbers nor sleeps. And now you see, again, there's a point to that, right? Other gods do sleep because they're like us. This God is not like that. Psalm 121, you know, it's a psalm that lots of people like. I'm not sure that we actually get it, though. It's a fierce piece of polemic, actually, Psalm 121. The God of the Old Testament does not know any shame or fear, does not commit crimes, does not commit misdemeanors, is morally superior to human beings. In all of these ways, you have a rejection of the surrounding cultural views of who God is. Numbers 23, verse 19, God is not a man that he should lie. You remember that text? So, we have a bit of give and take here. Yes, God is personal. Yes, we are like God in certain ways, analogously. And yet, God is absolutely not like human beings in all sorts of important ways. So, incomparable in all of these ways I've been describing. This last observation about incomparability leads on, I think, to the next and most important thing after we say that God is one and not many. I think that is the fundamentally important thing to say. But, of course, that is not to say everything that needs to be said, because as we saw from the Dawkins quote, it's possible to conceive of one incomparable sovereign creator who is nevertheless bad news, right? So when you say that God is one and incomparable and sovereign, you haven't yet said enough. For Dawkins, and I think for many people, and what Tony was saying about the suspicion of Marx and Freud and so on feeds into this as well. God could be all of the things I've just said, and yet also be unpredictable, untrustworthy, malevolent, capricious, and so on and so forth. And that would be the worst case scenario, right? Because you would have a monopoly of divinity in the cosmos, and it would all be bad. And that would not be good news. Polytheism would actually be an attractive option, if that were the case. So, the really big question that comes next is, okay, so God is sovereign and one and so on, but is God good? That's the fundamental question. Is God good? And this is where Dawkins and the Old Testament radically diverge. Because if there is one conviction about God that marks out our biblical authors above all, it is that God is good. And in spite of all the things we are told that might raise in our minds questions about that, there's no question that this was their conviction. So simply at the level of descriptive integrity, I think we first of all have to get that on the table. Right at the beginning of the biblical story, we are told this. We're told of God who creates a creation that is good, 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 very good. And that implies, of course, does it not, the creator must also be good. Certainly this idea of God's goodness comes out in the idea of blessing that we also get really immediately at the beginning of Genesis and all the way through, where God blesses the sea creatures and the birds and blesses human beings. And this blessing is seen exactly in a creation that is so perfectly designed for creatures' needs. Tremendous emphasis in Genesis on creation being just formed in such a way as to be entirely good for creatures. God even blesses the seventh day and makes it holy, which is a strange concept when you think about it. But it's interesting that notion of blessing applies even to the structure of the week in biblical thinking, as it were. So we have this notion of goodness. We have this notion of blessing. And of course, in the book of Exodus, people are told to observe the Sabbath for the good of all creatures, indeed, just reflecting that creation reality. It's not just people who rest on the Sabbath, it's animals and so on as well in the book of Exodus. So God is present in the world, blessing not just at the beginning, but in the structure of our week and all the way through our day. And the book of Genesis plays on this notion of blessing extensively all the way through the first 11 chapters of Genesis. And then into the beginning of chapter 12, where we discover that God calls out Abraham also with the intention of blessing. We won't be talking too much about Israel's story today. We will be talking about Israel's story fundamentally in a couple of weeks' time. But it's interesting to note that God's blessing in the world is not abandoned when things go wrong. When things go wrong in Genesis 1 to 11, in all the ways they go wrong, God's response is still at the end to bless. So after the flood, God blesses. After the Tower of Babel, God calls Abraham and says, I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make you a blessing. And all peoples on earth, in fact, will be blessed through you. So God commits himself there, not just to one people to bless, but through that one people to bless everyone else. And the power of God's blessing is actually seen very strikingly in the story of Balaam. Do you remember Balaam, who is he's a professional curser? It's his job, great job, I guess. And he's called in, you remember, by one of the ancient kings to curse Israel, and he can't do it. He's not able to, because the blessing of God rests on this people. And he finds that he's just unable, effectively, to curse. In the regular priestly rituals of Israel, you find this famous blessing, the Lord bless you and keep you and make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you, and so on. So this idea, very powerful, central idea of Old Testament thinking, that Israel knows the Creator God first and foremost as a God of blessing and a God who is good. Psalm 100 verse 5, for the Lord is good and his love endures forever. Psalm 23 verse 6, surely goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life. You know, very famous text, but particularly striking text when you compare this mindset to the mindset we were looking at earlier on, right? Where you might hope the God would bless you, but you're not fundamentally confident that the God is good, right? You never quite know where you are with these ancient gods. But there's a confidence here in the ongoing goodness of God. Indeed, Psalm 23 pictures God as being with us as sheep through our life, and also being with us at the end as a host welcoming us to the great banquet. That's the kind of, in a nutshell, the Israelite view of life. So God is clearly believed to be good and celebrated constantly as being good. Associated with that is the notion of God's love. I was talking the other day about Marcion, who found it difficult to find God's love in the Old Testament, but honestly, I just don't think he was trying hard enough, because the language of steadfast love is this Hebrew word chesed, which, by the way, is one of the great evidences that the Scots actually are some of the lost tribes of Israel, because we can actually say chesed, whereas many of you cannot. But anyway, steadfast love, celebrated all over the place. It's directed towards Abraham. Jacob recognizes that it's marked his life, even though he's a very questionable character. He looks back on it, sees God's steadfast love. Joseph is said to be a recipient of it. You have Psalms like Psalm 86. You are forgiving and good, O Lord, abounding in love to all who call to you. The earth is full of God's love, Psalm 33. It overflows into the heavens, Psalm 36. Lamentations 3, the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. That's quite a lot of stuff about love, right? You know, it's not very surprising, because Jesus tells us this God is his Father. And so you wouldn't expect to find a huge, you know, disjunction here. And when you go and read these texts, of course, you find they say a lot about the goodness and the love of God. Think of this. Here's one of the most common refrains in the Bible. So this is something that's said again and again and again, right? And that's a pretty good indicator of what it is that people fundamentally believe, right? So here is one of the great refrains of the Old Testament, that people ought to give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, his love endures forever. 26 times by my count in the Old Testament, right? So that's fairly significant. And then we have a couple of other words that refer to the same notion of God's love towards us. Two Hebrew words, racham and rachamim, they mean compassion. It's probably the best one-word translation. They are both of them related to another Hebrew word, rechem, which means a womb. And so you get this sort of linguistic suggestion that, in fact, this compassion is the deep love of God, similar to the love of a mother for a child. It's the love of the womb. In fact, in the famous story of Solomon, faced by the two women who both claim the child, we find that the real mother offers to give up her claim to the child so that the child will live. And the reason that's given is that she's filled with compassion for her son. That's the kind of thing that we're talking about. And so you get this developed in Jeremiah 31. Is not Ephraim my dear son, says God? Though I often speak against him, I still remember him. Therefore, my heart yearns for him. I have great compassion for him. Now, actually, that's not a great translation. Our English translations, unfortunately, the translators sometimes give the impression of trying to protect us from the biblical text by the way they translate. In fact, the text says, therefore my womb yearns for him. All parts of the human anatomy become the heart, I have discovered in English translations. So whereas Hebrew anthropology is very gutsy and earthy and talks about the spleen and the liver and the bile and stuff and all that gutsy intestinal stuff, we get this rather pathetic heart. It's very sad, actually. Isaiah 49, verse 15. Can a mother forget the baby at her breast and have no compassion on the child she has born? Not likely, but conceivable. Though she may forget, says God, I will not forget you. So the compassion of a mother for the child and then some. It's all part of the love of God. And the book of Hosea really gives the most extensive, I think, picture of God's love under all sorts of headings. And I won't leave this in the screen very long, so if you want to take those down, you can get it from me later on. Moving quickly on, steadfast love, of course, and a commitment to bless. Both of those imply faithfulness. I said earlier on that there's no notion of promises and covenants, therefore there's no notion of faithfulness in the ancient Near Eastern polytheistic systems, but it's a huge part of the biblical idea of God. Jacob, again, acknowledges God's kindness and faithfulness having marked his life. Exodus 34 describes God as abounding in love and faithfulness. Deuteronomy 7, know therefore that the Lord your God is God. He is the faithful God, keeping his covenant of love. And so on and so forth. Lots of examples, many more than I can possibly tell you about. Psalm 36, verse 5, your love, O Lord, reaches to the heavens, your faithfulness to the skies. So we're building up a cumulative picture here. This fundamental notion of the benevolence of God towards creation. And it's stable. It's not capricious. It's stable. It's ongoing. It marks every morning. All the language of continuity. A tremendous confidence that we're living in a world that is not arbitrary and unpredictable, but underlying everything, that there is this stability. Very different from the world I was describing of anxiety and fragility and so on earlier this morning. And then another idea that's connected to this, of course, is the notion that God rescues. If you ask, you know, what is one of the marks of this God that we're talking about, from the Israelite point of view, it is that God is constantly stepping in to rescue people from trouble. So this is not a distant God. It's not the one who is far away, you know, somewhere else, not active. The one, with the capital O, is somebody who is actively involved in rescue and redemption. God rescues creation from the flood, you remember, in early in Genesis. That story is replayed in small scale with the story of Moses, who is likewise saved from the midst of water. Do you remember that? It's an interesting feature there, by the way, that the little boat, do you remember the little thing that Moses floats away on in that story? It's actually in the Hebrew called an ark. It's the same word as is used for the ark back in the Noah story. So you see there's a recapitulation of the story about being saved out of the midst of water in the Moses story. The Exodus, of course, is the great biblical event that persuades the Israelites and generations ever afterwards that God is actively concerned about redeeming people from oppression and saving them. So that's true of the whole people. It's true of the whole world, actually. And then individual Israelites locate themselves within that story. And in the Psalms, they are constantly to be found praying, "Save me." There's an expectation that God cares, that God will keep promises, that God wants to intervene in our lives. And so people pray often in this way. Save me, O God. So individual Israelites, Israel as a whole, and the whole world beyond that. Isaiah 49 verse 6, "I will also make you a light for the Gentiles that you may bring my salvation to the ends of the earth." So the rescuing is a global rescuing. Isaiah 45, "Turn to me and be saved, all you ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other." You see, that's interesting, right? So the oneness of God, there's no other God, but actually that's a good thing, because this is a good God who's intent on saving. So it's not the worst case scenario, it's actually the best case scenario. One God, no rivals, therefore in the end, this God's will must be done. That's a great thing to know. There's no surprise about the outcome of the story we're bound up in, basically, right? Very different way of looking at the world to the earlier cultures we were looking at. So I want to maintain that it is absolutely clear in this literature we're dealing with that from the biblical author's point of view, God is good, that God intends to show creation good. In the language of the Apostle Paul, we could say that God is for us. Romans chapter 8. Intent on blessing creation, on loving it, on rescuing it. So there's a kind of bedrock spirituality here that leads the psalmist to say in Psalm 27, "I am confident of this, that I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living." So he's not having a good time in that psalm. But he is confident, nonetheless, that the goodness of God is going to prevail, that this bad moment is not the end of the story. That, I think, is the fundamental biblical posture. It's a posture of confidence. It's a posture of trust. It is the antithesis of the posture of suspicion struck by Feuerbach, Nietzsche, Marx, Freud, and Richard Dawkins, in fact. The more modern kind of posture of fundamental suspicion about the intentions of God, the character of God in the cosmos. And it is interesting to note that in the early chapters of the book of Genesis, it is in fact this suspicion of God, this distrust in the goodness of God, that's understood to lie at the heart of the human problem. There have been debates through the centuries, you know, about what the primary human sin is. And there are some fairly notable candidates, like pride, for example. And, you know, I don't disagree that obviously pride is a human problem, and there are lots of other ones. But actually, it seems to me there's a much deeper level here. I think that for the book of Genesis, the fundamental human problem lies in the adoption of an uncharitable, suspicious, distorted view of God, and that is what takes us on the first step along the path to alienation from God and from each other. Let me just explain why I think that. Again, it's a matter of reading text carefully. I'm sure you will know this story, in Genesis 2 of the creation and the garden and so on, where the Lord God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing to the eye and good for food. Notice, by the way, that God cares about aesthetics, not just about pragmatics, right? The trees look good. In the middle of the garden were the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The Lord God took the man and put him in the garden to work it, take care of it. And he commanded the man, "You are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will surely die." Now, notice the emphasis of that text. I read it with emphasis. God has created all things good, including all the trees. They are really useful, pragmatically. They're also beautiful. What are we to do with these trees? We are to enjoy all of them, except just one. That's the emphasis, right? So bounteous provision and goodness and generosity, and then a tiny, tiny, tiny prohibition, right? God is for us in this way of reading. Now, when the serpent gets going on this, notice what he says. He says to the woman, "Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?" Now, the careful Bible reader would respond at this point, "No, Mr. Serpent, that's not what God said." Right? He didn't say you must not eat from any tree in the garden. Notice the subtlety of this. It's a wonderful little case study on the Bible's view of temptation and how subtle it is. It's not, temptation doesn't work if it's blatantly, obviously temptation, right? It only works if it looks as if it might actually be good. That's how the business goes. Rather than emphasizing what God allows, the serpent emphasizes the prohibition. And in fact, he generalizes from the prohibition. So the serpent is suggesting a distorted view of God to the human pair. And unfortunately, they buy into it. And you see this in the woman's response, where she's partially right and partially wrong. "We may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say you must not eat fruit from the tree in the middle, and you must not touch it." Really? Didn't see that in the earlier passage. Very interesting. She's kind of more or less making up a rule. Right? So there's already a kind of buying into the whole thing. And as we know in the story, that's where the thing then begins to unravel. And the woman sees the fruit of the tree is good and pleasing to the eye, and all of that's true, and also desirable for gaining wisdom, which is a bit more questionable, and she takes some of it and eats it, and so on and so forth. It seems to me that the primary step, the primary problem there, is the posture adopted vis-a-vis God. That we are to adopt an uncharitable, suspicious, distorted view of God. And with the clouding of our minds that follows from that, then comes everything else all down the way. Now, why do I emphasize that just at the moment? It's not just because of Richard Dawkins or because of what Tony was saying earlier on. I say all of this because it seems to me that we also within the church suffer from a lack of larger context when we are reading bits of the Old Testament. And that we ourselves are often tempted into a similar kind of questionable posture. I think the appropriate starting point in terms of our reading of who God is to start with Genesis, for example, as I've done. You start at the beginning. And indeed then to notice all the different ways in which the goodness of God is then expressed, and I've done some of those. But I'm now going to mention a few things that Dawkins mentions, which are often not seen to be aspects of the goodness of God, and become a problem then, seem to be in tension with the notion of goodness. And I'm going to suggest that actually that's a mistake, and that all of these things I'm about to talk about are also aspects of God's goodness, and must rightly be understood in this way. Because after all, it would be very, very strange, would it not, if we had been bequeathed literature in which we were told half the time that God was good and half the time that God was malevolent, with no apparent order to it. It seems much more likely to me that the people who passed these texts down to us, who clearly had all of these fundamental convictions about God's goodness, also told us these other things, expecting us to read these other things in that context. That's my working hypothesis. Let's see how it goes. Let's think about the holiness of God, first of all. The holiness of God, I think, if you talk about the holiness of God and you've heard sermons on that or read books, it's often, I think, portrayed as something in the first instance that is very scary. It's very alienating. The holiness of God is a barrier between us and God, and it pushes away, and we're always right on the edge of tripping up and being smited, or whatever the old authorized version word is. God's holiness, though, in the Old Testament, is not presented just in that way. Holiness is, in terms of biblical thinking, simply God's goodness by a different name. That's my proposal. God's holiness is simply God's goodness by a different name. Hosea 11 verse 9 makes clear that the problem with God's holiness is not intrinsic to the fact that God is good. The problem comes only because God is good and we are often not. That's where the problem arises. So holiness is what differentiates God from us insofar as we are not ourselves entirely good. Hosea 11 verse 9 is a really interesting text in this context. My heart is changed within me, says God. All my compassion is aroused. I will not carry out my fierce anger, nor will I turn and devastate Ephraim, for I am God and not a man. Remember that I am God, I am not a man, that I should lie language? God is incomparable. Here, the incomparability lies in how God expresses his holiness, right? What he's saying here is, a human being might well strike out vengefully against those who have wronged him, but I, God, being holy, will not do that. So this is not the image of, you know, sometimes I think we carry with us the image, and I've met people like this, it's a real problem to them, you know, they live their lives looking over their shoulder the whole time in case they're going to put a foot out of line because they think that God's just waiting. He's just waiting, and he loves to smite, you know. And if you put a foot out of line, you're going to be smitten. That's not what Hosea 11, verse 9 says at all. In fact, God is entirely different in character, that verse says, from us. Isaiah 6, a very famous passage. Remember, Isaiah sees God in the temple, a vision of God. He's very struck by God's holiness. His reaction, quite naturally, is to say, I am ruined. I'm a man of unclean lips. And I've seen God, so he's seen God's pure goodness, and of course he's fearful. But what happens next? Does he get smitten? Indeed not. An angel picks up a coal from the fire and comes and purifies him, and then he's sent on his way to do God's business, right? The holiness of God is redemptive. It reaches out and embraces. In fact, I want to suggest to you that God's holiness is characteristically associated in the Old Testament, not with judgment, but with salvation. That's the case with Isaiah, as we've just seen. Be holy as I am holy. That's what God wants. Leviticus says that again and again. Be holy because I am holy. And then God takes steps to try and make that happen. And indeed, the whole ritual system of ancient Israel is designed to help and to educate Israel on how that happens. And in the prophetic literature, we have Zechariah telling us that in the end, this is what is going to happen. The glory of God will cover the whole earth, and holy to the Lord will be inscribed even on the bells of the horses and the cooking pots in the Lord's house, etc. In other words, everything that was marked off as holy for the purposes of education is only symbolic of the larger reality that everything, sacred and secular, if you want to use that language, becomes holy in the end. So biblically, it is true that the holiness of God, the goodness of God, can be dangerous to morally imperfect human creatures. That's certainly true. But it is also true that the Israelites believed it was not characteristically dangerous. In a way, a bit like the way, you know, if you see a bad traffic accident, you're inclined to linger and look at it. Some texts have that sort of hypnotic effect on us, and we're drawn to them, you know. So there are a few stories, and I really do mean a few stories, where the holiness of God devastates, and our eye is drawn to those for some reason. But I don't think actually that's what these authors who passed on this literature to us believe. I think what they believe was far closer to what C.S. Lewis believed. C.S. Lewis just so often, in my opinion, gets things right. Really smart Christian guy. And he gets them right in some very surprising places. If you know the Narnia Chronicles, you will certainly know The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where Mr. Beaver is telling his hearers for the first time about Aslan, the lion. And Lucy gets kind of worried, because lions are dangerous, right? And so here's how the text goes. "Isn't he safe?" said Lucy. "Safe?" said Mr. Beaver. "Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good." Isn't that brilliant? That nails, I think, what's going on here. Of course, that leads on naturally to the notion of God's anger, which is another set of problems, I think, that sometimes people raise. And certainly God is described on many occasions as being angry. Abraham fears the Lord's anger. Moses experiences it. It is unleashed against the Egyptians in the Exodus. It often burns against the people of Israel themselves. So, of course, anger is a very commonly mentioned reality. But once again, biblically, that is understood to be an aspect of God's goodness. It's not separate from God's goodness. It's not, the anger of God is not a whim. It's not caprice. It's not like the ancient gods. It's not like, you know, Zeus, was it, who flicked Odysseus across the Mediterranean just for the heck of it, you know? It's not that kind of thing at all. Indeed, biblically, we read that God's anger is never quickly or lightly expressed. Do you think how often that term is used, you know, that God is slow to anger? Have you ever noticed that? Their belief about God was that God could get very angry, and indeed rightfully so. But unlike us, this is anger that is slow to come to expression. And indeed, there's always a reason for it. In the ancient world, the gods didn't have to give you a reason for being angry, right? They just were. They could just be ticked off and take it out on you, and you would never know why. In biblical thinking, though, the anger is always related to what God has already told you about how you should be living and why and so on. It's the anger of a good person outraged by wickedness. And so this is a person, God, who is passionate about justice for the oppressed, right? And gets angry. Exodus 22, "Do not take advantage of a widow or an orphan. If you do, and they cry out to me, I will certainly hear their cry, and my anger will be aroused." And quite right too, right? Your anger should be aroused by that, and so should mine. It's a good thing that there's somebody looking out for the widows and the orphans and all the oppressed and brutalized of the earth. It's a good thing because it gives hope for a better world. It means the world will not always be like this. God cares enough about creation to be angry about evil and to do something about it. So anger is conceived, I think, as good. And yet, think of another well-known refrain, recurring notion in the Old Testament. God is, we are told more than once, a compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Now, as I say, the things that are said more than once we ought to pay attention to. These are the liturgical realities of ancient Israel, the things that were said in worship, right? These are the things that define the basic perspective. Even for those who suffer God's anger, there is hope. There is hope of restoration. The author of the book of Lamentations tells us that though God brings grief, he will show compassion, so great is his unfailing love, for he does not willingly bring affliction or grief to the children of man. There's an astonishing thought. God does not willingly bring grief or affliction. Now, it's interesting, I think. The Bible often talks about God delighting in mercy. I don't think there's a single instance where we're told that God delights in being angry. Anger is something that, in a sense, it doesn't quite fit. It's only there and necessary because of the evil that arises in the world. Richard Dawkins talks about the jealousy of God, you may remember, in that short clip from earlier on. And indeed, the jealousy of God is very much tied up with anger. But let's just ponder this for a moment. Dawkins seems very convinced that jealousy is also a bad thing. But you know, I actually don't think that's right. What is jealousy? Jealousy is intolerance of rivals, wouldn't you say? That's a pretty decent definition, right? Jealousy is intolerance of rivals, and God is often said to be intolerant of rivals, that is, these other gods which are not gods, right? Well, doesn't that, though, seem to you to be a perfectly appropriate response to gods who are not gods? Isn't the jealousy of God, in fact, something that's very much for our benefit, right? Because it's not good for us to worship gods that are not gods. So jealousy can, I guess, spill over into, you know, terrible behavior on the part of human beings. It's certainly not conceived of as spilling over into terrible behavior on the part of God. This is very much to do with putting things right and maintaining the right view of the cosmos. And the notion of vengeance, the other idea, is again just about making sure that justice happens. So if you look at Psalm 94, you read this: O Lord, the God who avenges, the God who avenges, rise up, O judge of the earth. You see? Vengeance is not just the kind of thing that we might do where we just rampage, you know, and we lose our temper and we, you know, react. With regard to God, it's all about this cry in the psalm: how long will the wicked be jubilant? And the psalmist says, God, avenge the oppressed. And it seems to me, to be honest with you folks, I used to be a bit embarrassed about the anger of God in the Old Testament. Now I'm embarrassed that I was embarrassed. Because I think it says a lot about my previous moral condition. That I thought that being angry about wickedness was somehow wrong. I don't really know where I picked that up from. But it seems to me to be profoundly mistaken. We ought to be angry about wickedness. And indeed, God is angry and ultimately will do something about it. And that brings us full circle back through some of the more difficult stuff to where, you know, I want to more or less end up with the notion of forgiveness. We've talked about this already, that holiness and judgment and anger and so on are really not distanced from forgiveness, because all of these are aspects of the goodness of God. And of course, the Israelites were quite convinced that this is a God who forgives. Here's Micah chapter 7, verse 18. Who is a God like you who pardons sin and forgives the transgression of the remnant of his inheritance? You do not stay angry forever, but delight to show mercy. There's that delight language once again. And notice here, this is another of these incomparability statements, right? Who is a God like you? And one of the things the author now is focusing on is there's no God like this in the ancient world either. There's no God like this who pardons sin and forgives transgression. And of course, you see that, don't you? I mean, the other gods, being just like us, do not have much capacity for self-giving love. But the Israelites believed that God was somebody who fundamentally created out of self-giving love and rescues out of self-giving love and doesn't need us to feed his ego and therefore forgives. It's not a matter of standing on your honor with this God. This is a God who delights to show mercy. Okay, well, to sum all of that up, because we're coming towards the end of our time, who is God in this biblical literature? Fundamentally, I think, this is God who is good. Which is to say that God is holy. I think we need to hold these two ideas very closely together. And then this goodness stroke holiness of God comes out in all sorts of ways, and all of these things are aspects of it. We can't discard one of these and still have a biblical view remaining. All of these things are part of this view. God's goodness and holiness are seen in God's blessing, in God's love, in God's faithfulness, in God's rescuing, and also in God's anger, God's jealousy, God's vengeance and forgiveness. All of these add up to what our biblical authors thought was the truth, that God is incomparably good when you consider who God reveals himself to be in the context of these ancient cultures. There is no other God like this, and this is something we don't actually just have to take on faith, because we know enough about the other gods to see exactly that this is an empirical statement. there is in fact no other God like this in the ancient world, and all the ways in which that is true I've tried to unpack for you in these various ways. Just one footnote then on all of that. I am struck in all of this precisely by this notion of the self-giving nature of God in Hebrew thinking. Remember that in the cultures at large, the cosmos functions for the gods and in relation to the gods, and human beings are an afterthought. The biblical worldview is very different from that. Whereas for the average Mesopotamian, religion was about getting on with your job as an afterthought in the system, hoping to stay out of trouble, derive some benefit from so doing, and eventually get a rest in the underworld, even though it wasn't very pleasant. Biblical religion is entirely different in atmosphere and tone and outlook. Here we have one personal God, sovereign over the whole cosmos, therefore able to deliver justice. God's holiness or goodness marks out his character, which is consistent, right? You can depend on it from day to day, every morning, every evening. You know what he expects because he tells you. This is the world of divine revelation. You don't have to work it out or guess. What he expects fundamentally, it turns out, is that we should be like him. So there's a whole moral core to this. It's a relational matter, right? In fact, the biblical worldview, and this is the most astonishing thing, is that the cosmos was constructed with human beings centrally in mind. They're not an afterthought, right? God's purpose in creating was to bless. It wasn't to create a slave class so that his own needs could be met. God's purpose in creating was to bless, to show love and faithfulness, to rescue from danger and distress, and to forgive and to restore. There is nothing in all of that about God creating to meet his own needs. In biblical view of things, creation doesn't happen because God needs anything. And of course, a Christian view then of God later on in terms of Trinitarian relatedness further grounds all of that by suggesting that, God is entirely self-sufficient in terms of relational love. So God doesn't create because God needs to, in biblical thinking. God creates out of an overflow of God's love. It's all about us. I said earlier on that the other cultures, it was all about the gods. The biblical tradition is utterly humanistic in the best possible sense of that word. Human beings are elevated to this extraordinary status, just a little lower than the gods, says Psalm 8, right? Every human being precious as being made in God's image. We'll get to more of that later today. So what is religion on this view? Religion is about entering joyfully into the work of God in the world. It's an utterly different. I mean, if you read these ancient texts with all of their agonizing and worrying and anxiety, and then you read the Psalms, it's like night and day, right? Because it's all about rejoicing as being a co-worker with God, enjoying all the things God has already given to us freely, whereas, you know, part of the job of the slave class was to feed the gods. In Genesis 1, God creates the trees so that we can eat and we can have enough. So it's a very, very different world, and it's not surprising that this view of God has come to be embraced by so many people who inhabit cultures very similar to the cultures we've just been talking about. And it's certainly not surprising that when they do so, their entire world is transformed, not just individually, but societally, politically, economically, because all of these things, in fact, hang together. And we'll see a bit more of how this plays out this afternoon when we talk about the other side of that, the idea of creation. 1202, not bad, eh?
I think furthermore, Ian, we should be lifting the grade up towards 9.5, I think. So thank you very much. That was fantastic, and I just love the way you quietly give us building blocks, you know, from first principles. So when we come back after lunch, which is what's our time? What's our regathering time? About an hour.
1 o'clock.
About 1 o'clock. Yeah. Thank you. We'll go into discussion groups. I just want to give you a few little thought starters on what you might talk about and think about. I think some, you know, you might actually have some questions around clarification, you know, and issues, and you know, what about this or what about that? What did that mean, etc. So expect that. I think that's useful. In other words, it might not all make sense, or there might be, you know, some points at the edge that still bother you, or so on. But I think then, beyond that, what lots of you might think about might be consequences. So what? You know, I mean, this leads to, you know, what does this lead to in terms of different ways of thinking, or etc., which is quite exciting. I mean, I think the consequences of what this more fully rounded worldview gives us are really, really interesting. And so you could almost say, well, I accept what you've done. I accept the argument, makes sense. It would have this effects in how we think, or etc. So you could also go there. You also might reflect on, which I think is a really good question, you know, what were some of the jewels? What were some of the, you know, really precious? That was really good. I mean, I think that the insights that came out would be a nice thing to share as well. So, I think there are different ways that you might go into the discussion. A fourth way, which I'm also interested in, is in the sense of a story. You know, what bits of this really seemed to challenge where I am, or how have they confirmed part of my journey? You gave us your story. You said that you didn't believe a lot of this stuff years ago, and you've made a couple of comments like that. I think one of the questions you were asked last night, you said, struck you as strange, but then you could remember thinking the same way yourself a long while ago. So there are different ways we could talk about. I think beyond all of that, there's probably another issue, which is, you know, if you weren't here, how would we summarise to somebody who wasn't here what went on? Which is a bit of a challenge, because you often have the experience, wow, this was good, and then go to a friend and say, this was fantastic. So what did he say? Can't quite remember, but it was really good. and I think, you know, ways to encapsulate and summarise this on our own are pretty important as well. But essentially, you've been really helping transform our worldview, and I've been thinking, Mark, about what you say about Romans 12, which later on, you know, you might share with us how Paul was really interested in the game of transformation of worldviews at a very deep fundamental level, which we've talked about in the New Testament. I think you'll bring the Old Testament into that same game. So that's really fabulous stuff. You made one comment at the end there, which was this view is putting human beings at the centre of the whole of creation. And Ron, you know much more about the new physics than I do, but the what's now called, I think, the anthropic principle in physics, which is you could also talk to us about and blow our minds, which is completely from a different world. Physicists and so on are coming to the view or the realisation that this whole world seems to have been designed with us at some razor edge focal point. And one of the most interesting lectures, or funniest lectures I've been to in my life, was by a magnificent physicist called Robert Susskind, Susskind, who's out of Berkeley, who's one of the authors of what's called string theory. And I went to a lecture in Berkeley to listen to him talk. I didn't understand much of it. It was a public lecture. And by the way, if you're interested in understanding more of the new physics and matter, then just Google Susskind, because he's got phenomenal one to 1.5 hour things like what you're doing. He explains the on the new physics is really good stuff. Because he actually says, look, he asks for an average age of people in the room. We're all sort of 50, 60, 70. He says, guys, we haven't got long. I'm not going to muck around with you like I do with, with undergraduates. I'm going to give you the whole deal in 1 hour. So that's what we need. But he's not a Christian. And this lecture was just fascinating. Him trying to kind of say, look, I know it looks like there's a God. I know it looks awfully like there's a God. I know it looks awfully like we're at the centre of it all. But I still don't believe it. And here's why. He was just struggling to get himself out of a corner. So thanks again, and we'll regather here in about an hour's time. Sue, do we have any other instructions to?
Yeah, I'll just make a prayer about lunch. If you're having lunch here, I thought the sort of coffee here would be fine, but we're here around here. Some of you who